continuing with part two of Jeff Booth's The Greatest Game. So let's get into it. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, everybody? We've got a late post today. Sorry about that. We've been on the road all day. I am in the mountains. And happy fucking New Year. We're just a couple hours away. But I wanted to make sure that I got this published before we closed out 2020. And, oh man, we got a couple hours to cross 30,000. I'm pretty stoked about that. Let's see if we make it. If you missed yesterday's episode, you gotta go back, because you don't want to hear the end of the piece before you hear the beginning. We are continuing with part two of The Greatest Game by Jeff Booth. And it is an awesome piece, so you gotta get the whole thing. Real fast, I want to thank our boss-ass sponsors. If you need a solid hardware wallet that is simple and secure, BitBox will make your cold storage dreams come true. And if you want to live off of Bitcoin, have a no-fee exchange with mobile banking services, Level.co is where it's at. Check those out at guyswan.com. I made some really pretty, like, fancy-looking icons, and they're right at the top of the page if you want to check those out. But for now, it's time to get into part two of The Greatest Game.
The Challenger Perspective. A system design that allows humanity to move from scarcity to abundance. Like most breakthroughs that make our lives better, one of the most interesting things in the battle between the monopoly system and the challenger is that the challenger, Bitcoin, has structural advantages that allow it to get stronger as the existing monopoly system weakens. Said another way, many of the reactions described above to protect the existing system strengthen the challenger's status as a store of value, whilst the network effects of more users bring more trust and constantly enhance the value of the system. As this network effect continues, eventually each country in the existing system will face an important choice. The existing system can either 1. Start to embrace the challenger, Bitcoin, and start accumulating it on their own for an eventual peg to their own currency. This will only serve to increase the volatility of the challenger's network effect and cause others to do so as well. This means early adopting countries, like the people and the companies before them, have a larger benefit as the price moves higher because of increased trust and competition for its utility as a store of value. If this were to happen, Bitcoin's 10x advantage as a store of value would be cemented, but its innovation and advancement to the rest of the economy would probably stop there. The on-ramps and off-ramps to individual currencies would continue to function within governments, which would be pegged to Bitcoin. Or, 2. Attempt to stop it. To do so would require a coordinated fashion, since individual companies trying to stop Bitcoin's advance would lead back to number 1, by creating an additional incentive for early adopting countries. Should it happen in a coordinated fashion, the technological innovation will move beyond Bitcoin's utility as a store of value, its first 10x, rapidly. In addition to being accepted as a better store of value, it will quickly become a better medium of exchange, easier to use, as a swarm of, quote, cyber hornets, hat tip to Michael Saylor, rush in to drive the technology forward. When dealing with technology, most people fall into the trap of projecting their current experience with technology forward, instead of thinking about how fast the underlying technology and user experience are advancing. By projecting a current experience forward, they fail to grasp the magnitude of what will happen. To illustrate this important point, look no further than the internet itself, which benefits from a similar network effect and growth rate as Bitcoin. The internet in 1995 had approximately 16 million users versus about 5 billion users today. In 1995, use cases for the internet were very narrow, leading many to discount what would come next. But entrepreneurs and investors looking to what the future could hold built some of the largest companies today on top of that new paradigm. Amazon, Google, Facebook, Alibaba, and many others. In my opinion, with either of these two outcomes, Bitcoin, the challenger, is likely to become the foundation of a new monetary system, one that is congruent with where human innovation and technological progress are taking us. With technology, there is an exponential effect in its output or power relative to its price. In other words, we get far greater benefit and the price continues to fall. This should come as no surprise. It is all around us. Your phone provides just one example. 20 years ago, it was only a phone. Today, it is a phone, email, text device, social network, camera, AI assistant, map, music player, and thousands of other things combined for a fraction of the cost previously available. That is, by definition, deflationary, which is a great thing if you understand how a new system could work to benefit humanity. In my book, The Price of Tomorrow: Why Deflation is Key to an Abundant Future, I detail how that technology is moving into every industry at an exponential pace. And while it is easy to get fooled looking backwards, most of the technological gains are in front of us, which means getting more for less. Deflation is a completely natural process that embraces human innovation. A new monetary system like Bitcoin that prevented manipulation would embrace that natural process. It would mean that our innovation and technological advances would translate into freeing our time, while concurrently enjoying higher living standards. When reframed that way, it's hard to imagine anyone wanting to stop it. Yes, prices would fall and keep falling, as technology and a free market did away with a false construct of needing more growth to pay for prices that were only manipulated higher through money printing in the first place. With prices falling to their natural level and on a path to free, the entire infrastructure required to support price inflation, which was only caused by ignoring the free market, will fall away. It is not logic that makes this difficult to see. Instead, it's because of the attempt to fit a current worldview, which dominates your attention, into a new one that is incongruent with that system. That incongruence of two systems competing in one's mind results in a conflict. We have an inability to see how much of the existing system of cost falls away under a new system, and how much cheaper it becomes to live. So we hold onto our past framework that we know manipulates prices higher for fear of loss. We fail to comprehend that many of our biggest societal issues today might solve themselves under a new standard like Bitcoin. For instance, the manipulation of money is, by an order of magnitude, the greatest contribution to environmental destruction that no one talks about. Again, most of humanity's attention is focused on the independent variables of the system instead of the system itself. One of the independent variables in this case being fossil fuel energy to keep with the growth. We miss that the manipulation of money is artificially driving higher prices and growth, along with the need for more of everything to pay for those higher prices. As entrepreneurs innovate and bring lower prices to the market, ever more manipulation is required to offset this benefit. More energy, more jobs, more consumption, more production, more transportation, on an ever-increasing feedback loop, just to keep it going. And that is the truly revolutionary power of Bitcoin over the long term. As it continues its advance and eventually becomes a global reserve currency, it shatters the societal patterns we currently call reality. As more people start to realize what that means for society after the transition, more people will also realize that many current, quote, realities were really only self-imposed prisons. I'll attempt to show this by way of another example in education. Today, with an internet connection and browser, We already have access to many of the world's best minds, research papers, and content for free. KhanAcademy.org provides just one example, offering a completely free education anywhere in the world in math, physics, science, and computing. The courses and user experience are designed to make learning engaging and ensure mastery of the subjects. Those opportunities are everywhere. A staggering amount of detail on any subject, all there for us to learn. For the curious with enough willpower and perseverance, a great education is already free. So then why, given this inescapable fact, do we choose to spend our time in school for 12 years to compete to get into the best college when it is both more time-consuming and costly? We do so because historical societal patterns, our perceived reality, tell us that it is the best way to get a good-paying job. That may have been true, especially looking back to a time before technology brought that abundance of information to us. It may even be somewhat true for some jobs today, but it also is likely to be less true in the future. For some, that future is already here. From my own experience in hiring thousands of employees over the years, I would take the curious, self-driven learner every time. The perception of scarcity. 1. That education from the best schools is required to have a good career. And 2. There are only a limited number of spaces available in those schools, means the cost and competition for those spaces are constantly rising, which the system reinforces without us even questioning it. Our self-imposed prison. That same perceived scarcity creates an education system that increases inequality, because access to education, and along with it the best jobs, becomes more about an ability to pay than curiosity and drive. Ironically, at the same time, abundance of free or almost free education is already all around us, with the change in hiring that will soon follow suit. It forces us to the realization that economics is not about value, but scarcity, real or perceived. It is difficult to charge money for abundance for the same reason it is difficult to charge for the oxygen we breathe. As something becomes abundant, the ability to monetize it drops. Where does economic value come from? We can look at the overall economy in a free market as a sum total of trillions of continuing experiments competing to create value for us. An endless swarm of innovation and experimentation by entrepreneurs driven to succeed, with money as a measurement of that success. That experimentation comes in all forms and sizes, from a new local restaurant carrying the hopes and dreams of a family with it, to an idea like Amazon that emerges quickly as a new dominant platform. Transportation, space travel, health, education, each playing field is dynamic, constantly changing and evolving. Past success doesn't guarantee the future. Ask any entrepreneur. It is not a journey for the faint of heart. The competition is brutal, and in a free market, it is not only the entrepreneur and their early employees at risk of losing everything in a new venture. The capital that bets on those entrepreneurs either wins along with success or loses with its failures. Which is another way of saying, businesses are always on the hunt for ways to improve, because if they don't, they die. We determine their value by the value they bring to us. A free market that allows creative destruction to work, then, results in more experiments and more value created in our lives. Technology amplifies this entire process, and with it, will bring breakthroughs to our lives that were previously inconceivable and open the doors for almost anyone to create them. This becomes a feature of a monetary system backed by Bitcoin because it forces out manipulation and, as a result, distributes broad societal gains as a natural consequence. Because, unmanipulated, The result of all of that free market competition must give us more for less, or we wouldn't use it. This is to say that a monetary standard like Bitcoin would ensure the exponentially improving value created by a combination of technology and competition would fall in price to match the new realities of supply and demand in a digital world. That seemingly small change, unnoticed by most of society, changes everything else. In time, society will realize that it also allows for an expansion of the very meaning of success. In the great game of business, a monopoly rarely dies overnight. They have too much market power for that. What often happens is that they miss a key technological change that would have allowed them to offer value differently, and then set out on a series of actions to protect their existing business. Because the change delivers better value to society, those actions to protect what was all but guaranteed failure in the end. It is exactly the same thing, playing out before our eyes in the greatest game of all, the international monetary game and the rise of Bitcoin, which is connected to everything else. For the first time in history, though, the unique characteristics of Bitcoin give everyone a choice on how they play the game. I suspect that as more people come to understand how remarkable this breakthrough is for money and what it means, that things will never be the same. Learn about Bitcoin. Learn why its importance is so much greater than the wealth it might create for you and your family. When you do, teach others. Their futures may depend on it. It is bound to be an epic battle. A battle between the free market and entrepreneurs competing to create more value on one side, and manipulation and power concentrated in the hands of a few, eventually leading to totalitarian control on the other. My hope for humanity is that we are on the winning side. By Jeff Booth. Hell yeah. So let me get a drink real quick. We'll hit our sponsor for today, and then we will come right back and get into Guy's take. Level.co, and that's LVL.co, so drop the vowels. These guys are bringing something amazing to the Bitcoin space. This is the first free exchange and banking services in North America. The Level mobile app lets you buy and sell Bitcoin without any trading fees or hidden spreads. So the free version gets you free Bitcoin trading, a hosted wallet, a FDIC-insured checking account, wires, checks, and direct deposit, and you can purchase for $10 a MasterCard debit card. Get the premium for just $9 a month, and you have access to an autopilot trading bot, 30% off of some of the other transaction fees, chat with a dedicated private banker, and a metal World Debit MasterCard. And the best thing about the metal card, there is no fee nor a spread to spend cash from Bitcoin on the card. It is available in 28 states right now, and they expect to be available to 94% of the U.S. population by the end of 2021, with the exception of, sorry, everybody in New York. But this is an incredible new service, a full-on suite of Bitcoin banking services, and you should definitely check it out today at LVL.co. You know, if there is one thing about the fiat monetary system, about the monetary systems that we have had over the last 100 or so years, that you could begin to wrap your head around and really, really think about how many different things are a consequence of this one problem and this one unnatural element of our monetary system, of our economic systems, is that all prices naturally fall. All of them. All the time. If an economy gets more productive, which is the natural state of the economy, that's how the economy works, it's a never-ending competition to become more productive, more efficient, and more valuable. With a natural money in a free market, Given enough time, all prices naturally fall. Everything gets cheaper because that's the very job of the economy. That's what the entire mission of economic progress is, to make things cheaper and better, to provide value for other people better than the current methods that are already being employed. Now stop and think about how many problems there are in society just connected, not second order, third order effects from this manipulation of our money, but just flatly the things that get ridiculously expensive and cannot be paid for. That is because of our money. It necessarily cannot constantly increase in price unless we are constantly increasing the amount of debt and money in society. And then understand that that is only the beginning of the problems that our monetary system causes. That's just the most obvious things. And it takes a monumental amount of restrictions, of manipulation, of money printing, and price controls in order to fight that. It's a really strong natural force, and it's accelerating on top of itself. And this is what his whole book, The Price of Tomorrow, is really about, is how powerful the deflationary effects of information technology truly are, and the fact that this is moving into every industry. There's always been some industries and products and things that have basically been on the outside of it, that digital technology has not been able to get an order of magnitude increase in efficiency in production, and those things are also now being consumed by digital technologies. This is not going to get better, or worse, I guess you could say. The deflation is going to accelerate. It's going to get more pronounced as we move into the future. And that additional value, that additional productivity, should be the value that accrues to the money. That is how you measure how a society gets wealthier. That is how you measure the actual productivity and the actual value accrual of the economy as a whole. It is a better metric than the GDP by a long shot. If you could just measure the deflation of the economic money, of the money in an economy, that increased purchasing power is roughly the increased value of the economy as a whole. So if prices across the board essentially fall by 5%, well, then the economy is roughly 5% more productive and more valuable than it was over the past year. And you know where that value is accrued to? You know who is the beneficiary of all of that excess value? The people who did all the work. The people who actually traded, who actually produced, the entrepreneurs who actually risked it all, the people who participated in the economy. That's how you share it around. That's how you split up all the excess value that has been created in the economy as morally and fairly as you possibly can. And instead, we have a political system that not only manipulates and wastes so many resources to consume every bit of additional productivity and value produced, but that sets a target for a 2 to 3% loss of value. All of the benefit of our hard work accrues to them, and they take another 2 to 3% off the top by their own shit CPI metrics when they're actually taking another 10%. That thing needs to be cut off. That system needs to commit suicide. It needs to be done. That, above all else, is why I'm in Bitcoin. That shit system needs to die. You know, Jeff Booth actually has one of the coolest explanations I've heard in a while for what the economy is, what a free market is, how to describe it, I guess you could say. I'm going to read this quote. I'm actually like way skipping down the whole first section and jumping right to the end. The quote is, "We can look at the overall economy in a free market as a sum total of trillions of continuing experiments competing to create value for us. An endless swarm of innovation and experimentation by entrepreneurs driven to succeed with money as the measurement of that success. That is such a great way to think about the game theory and the incentive structure of a natural economy, is that it's a game. It's a game of trying to compete to produce more value than the other person. We're fighting to be better than everyone. And in doing so, it brings out the best. It brings out all of the most brilliant and out there experiments and encourages people to take risk and actually produce something of meaning in the world. And that money is a measurement of the success of how well they created value for someone else. Again, I've said this so many times, but money is a proxy. It is not value in and of itself. It is representative of the other value, the other resources in the economy. You can't eat money. And it makes it even more clear when we're talking about Bitcoin. I can't do anything with Bitcoin but have it be a promise for the portion of the value, the portion of the economy that I have provided, established, protected value for. When money can't be manipulated, it is representative of the amount of value and the amount of resources that you have produced and made available for someone else without having consumed it. You know, if I have a job that I am cutting people's lawns, and I've cut, you know, 100 lawns, 1,000 lawns in a year, and I save all of that money, that savings didn't steal anything from anyone. It blows my mind that people believe this fallacy, that that person is like evil and they're keeping something from someone, when the fact that they have savings is proof that they cut those thousands of lawns, that they did 1,000 favors for other people, and their savings is proof that they haven't taken anything back. They've gotten nothing out of their labor yet. All they've done is store it so that they can get something of it back later. To steal it from them at that point is to force them to be a slave to everyone whose lawn they cut. Or actually to the person who took the value. So whoever counterfeited the money, whoever stole the savings, it is making that person a slave to them. It is saying, you worked and produced all of this value, and I'm going to consume it and give you nothing in return. Money is the scorekeeper for how much good you have done in the world that has actually been voluntarily traded with other people. When the trade is honest, when the money is honest, and when the market is uncorrupted, that is what it means. Now back to the beginning section of this, there's a game theory. And I was talking about this on Pierre Richard's really great piece, The Speculative Attack, on the Nakamoto Institute. I'm sure you guys have all heard it, but like, Thayer's Law or Gresham's Law about how bad money drives out good money, and how you can essentially attack bad money by leveraging the bad money to buy the good money. And the whole Gresham's Law theory, if you don't know Gresham's Law, if you haven't heard Gresham's Law, you haven't listened to enough of Bitcoin Audible. We talk about it all the time. It's key to understanding all this stuff. So go back, listen to episodes. I don't even know which one it would be. Just do all of them. You'll be fine. This is something fascinating in the battle between money, between a good money and a bad money, is that the very nature of Bitcoin, the very nature of a sound money that enters a weak money economy, is that every measure, every dollar amount, every Bitcoin amount, whatever the value measure is, every measure, a unit of value that goes into the strong money necessarily goes out of the weak money. So as the weak money gets weaker, the strong money is getting stronger. It's a feedback loop, and it is one of those things that always tends toward a monopoly, quote unquote, in the communication protocol. All monies tend toward one. And absent of any huge market restriction or any manipulation or the ability of it to be corrupted, it will always go to the soundest money. The incentives are simply too strong to stop that. And that is where you get into a really interesting position when Bitcoin, I think this is it. This is 2021 is when Bitcoin gets on the global stage. And I think, it is on the global stage, but it's only just creeping onto the stage. It's, you know, interstage left Bitcoin with all this insane macroeconomic and political turmoil that we have basically across the world right now. But as Bitcoin walks into that environment, is that there's a very interesting game theory. Bitcoin is going to, I think, explode. So, what's the word? Unforgivingly. Basically, it will not be halting for anyone. And there will be almost, it will, as they say, as you see all the time, it will literally melt faces. But 2021, in doing so, when it becomes so prominent in the discussion, in the macro environment, as a political tug of war, like whatever it is, like as it becomes so cemented as a critical thing to be concerned about, 2021 will be the year that every country, every government and jurisdiction makes a stance on Bitcoin, one way or the other, whether they are for it, against it, or whether they are simply going to be hands-off and try to fit it into the framework that they already have. I think this is the year when everybody draws the line, because it is going to be so loud and so impossible to ignore that basically no political entity will be able to get around not making some sort of statement about it. It'll be like, you know, you're in your yard or something and you're having an interview and your house is literally exploding and on fire and it's going nuts and you're trying to pretend that the only important thing to be talking about is the height of your lawn, of your grass. And every time somebody tries to, the reporter tries to ask you, well, what about the fire? Like, literally, this thing is exploding. My face is melting. We're standing too close to this. And you're like, no, the grass is great. The grass is great. You know, we try to keep it trimmed to about a 2, 2.5. I think not saying something about Bitcoin and not making it known your position on it will feel like that in 2021. And essentially, this game theory plays out one of two ways. And Jeff Booth lays it out in this, and this is something that has been, it's so weird to see. I think we're actually entering the phase when this becomes the reality, because, you know, people, some of the hardcore Bitcoiners were talking about this in 2013, when Bitcoin was almost nothing, when you could count the number of people who were, you know, in this space on, you know, your fingers and your toes. But if you play out the logic, if you play out the incentives, this is where we were going. If Bitcoin didn't die, this is where this was going to go. And so basically there are two options. Is that either the country embraces Bitcoin and starts accumulating under the realization that it might be useful to peg, it might actually make their own currency stronger. I mean, think about it in the context of MicroStrategy, right? Is MicroStrategy just adopted a Bitcoin standard and their stock is skyrocketing right alongside the price of Bitcoin? A country that does the same could position themselves as a powerful capital allocator in the future. And this will double down on the FOMO, on the institutional and jurisdictional FOMO to have some sort of exposure to Bitcoin. And more importantly, to have exposure before someone else does this. Because if you let someone else get a head start, suddenly your relevance on the macro political environment is just chopped down. If we're talking about monetizing a new asset, something that could go from $1 trillion to $10 trillion, could go from $4 trillion to $20 trillion, that could have moves like this and be such a vast shift in where people hold value, the benefit of doing that early at that level, again, it's impossible to ignore. It's the prisoner's dilemma in reverse. It's the prisoner's dilemma for all the countries. The reward for defecting, even if anybody attempts to cooperate, the reward for defecting is massive for the one that decides to do so. So if in the reverse, if the number two takes precedence and they try to stop it, and there's a massive global coordination against Bitcoin, they still lose. Because if they can't break Bitcoin, if they can't actually destroy it, the one defector, the inevitable subset of countries that they cannot get to cooperate, will soak up so much value in such a short period of time, it will be staggering. And now he actually adds something to this section that I'm not so sure. I don't really agree with it. Is that he said that if it becomes the ultimate store of value, Bitcoin's, you know, has the 10x advantage in that context. That it will be cemented as the store of value, and that, quote, its innovation and advancement to the rest of the economy would probably stop there. I totally disagree here. I think he is liking this to gold, is that because gold was the store of value, you know, it essentially became just that job. But gold is not a permissionless platform. It's not a protocol. I mean, you could argue that, you know, the gold atom validation, the characteristic, is a protocol, but you know, you get what I'm saying. Gold is a physical thing. So after becoming the dominant store of value, there was no it had such a monetary premium that there was no reason to do anything else with it. It was so much more valuable as a money than it was to, you know, make stuff out of it, unless you were literally just trying to show off your wealth. It stayed with jewelry, it stayed with store of value and money, and basically everything else fell as secondary or tertiary uses. Bitcoin, I don't think, has that problem, because Bitcoin is a permissionless protocol. It is an information protocol, and the value in it is as a store of value all the way down to the individual level. There will be no way that the government can stop people from building on it. Like Lightning Network, like we will need payment systems. Like he talks about actually early in section one of this, like yesterday's episode. He talks about, like, you know, the thing about like wanting hyper Bitcoinization very quickly is that we be careful what we wish for, is that the entire financial system is built on top of it. All of the infrastructure, all of the services, all of the businesses, the all of the things that make our food, make our lives comfortable, keep our houses heated, all of these things are built on the fiat monetary system, and they will collapse if that system collapses as well. That means we got to replace all that stuff, or at least the monetary foundations of those things. That means payment processors. That means payment networks. That means new utilities, new services and non-custodial contracts and, you know, Lightning Networks and DLCs and shadow chains and side chains and federated chains and state chains, like all the different tools and things that we can do with this. That's not going to stop because it became such a massive store of value that we didn't find anything else to do with it. We'll do everything that you can and would want to do with value. I actually think it would accelerate just as fast actually probably faster, just because it will be so far out in the open and so much more valuable if it ends up being adopted as the dominant reserve currency in this context. In the flip side that he talks about, where if the governments try to fight it, the cyber hornets will come out and make it a better medium of exchange and make it easier to use and fast and cheap. I think that will actually have to do more with privacy, is that if it becomes adopted and governments embrace Bitcoin as the ultimate store of value, as the reserve currency, that there will be less push for cypherpunk solutions, that the cyber hornets will still, you know, try to build their encrypted and fully decentralized payment networks and fully private solutions and all of these things, but they will not be the ones that catch hold. There will be an open economy if you know, governments don't fight against it, that moves faster because centralization and ease of use is more convenient, and therefore it will lead to more control. And I think we'll have to go through another cycle before we really get all of the another one of the many cycles, like decade cycles of the internet. In fact, actually, this is kind of lacking back to I haven't done this episode yet, Giacomo Zucco's piece, Bitcoin and the Hopf Cycle, which may be coming on Friday, probably next week, actually, before I actually get it released. So sorry about that. But that's going to be a really great episode, and it's a phenomenal concept about how to apply the evolutionary and social cycles of the strong men create good times create weak men create bad times create strong men. That cycle, and how this actually applies to the internet and technology. This is kind of a broad evolutionary process that you can actually see in a lot of different ways. And I refer to it as the two steps forward, one step back process, which is just kind of turning it into two eras or two seasons as opposed to four. But I want to talk all about it on that episode, so I won't go too far. But in a sense, though, is that I think there will be, we will leave more systemic risk in the new infrastructure if it becomes a dominant reserve currency very quickly and governments essentially don't put up much of a fight. Whereas if governments put up a whole lot of fight, it will be more robust. The tools will be harder to break, more decentralized, and more private. And it will take longer to get to that new era. But when we do, there will be absolutely no stopping it. So I kind of think the medium of exchange and ease of use elements of Bitcoin, the expansion of the protocol, just like the expansion of the internet and its involvement or its takeover in every possible industry, media, YouTube, advertising and Google and publishing with Amazon and Apple and copyright and BitTorrent and retail. Good God. I mean, just everything. I mean, the internet, everything that you could do with the internet took over. And now basically it's doing that to money. But Bitcoin as its own value layer, I actually think is actually at a base layer below the internet. But it will do the same thing. I just don't see how we stop it from obliterating the models for insurance, obliterating the models for debt and collateral, obliterating all the models for almost every custodial financial service that you can think of, obliterating international exchange and Forex trading. Like, I think the idea of Forex will be a thing of the past. If you have a global reserve currency and you don't have to switch back and forth between currencies, you don't need it. I think payment processors are going to be, like, Visa has never had to worry about competition. MasterCard, like these huge giants, they have such amazing walled gardens. They even use old, crazy, outdated code that's used almost nowhere else just to continue to hold on their monopoly of the payment systems. In fact, there's a really good piece. Is it by Roy Scheinfeld? Is it by the Breeze guys? I can't remember. But it's a piece called, I'll try to remember to put it in the show notes, but it's about the Lightning Network as a global payment infrastructure. And they really get into, God, who was that? It's not, I don't think it's the Breeze guys. Whatever, I'll figure it out. It's a really great piece that kind of lays out how the current payment structure and infrastructure works. How it is that Visa, you know, manages such an incredible monopoly over that, essentially, and why Bitcoin and the Lightning Network is actually so well suited or poised to just completely pull the rug out from under them. But I think it's going to do it all. Bitcoin is just absolutely going to upend everything that we think of in the financial system. And I think that's whether governments are very friendly to it or whether governments are hostile to it. I think the major difference is the how it does all of those things, how it disrupts all of those things, and then the degree, the speed with which it does those things. But I think they happen either way, and Bitcoin only has to survive. And going back to Jeff Booth's examples, whether the governments take one or two, there's no, the outcome is essentially the same. Bitcoin is likely to become a dominant foundation of a new monetary system, one that is global, one that has no borders, one that is open and permissionless, and one that enables innovation and technological progress, particularly in the concept of finance and money and exchange and trade, that we cannot even begin to imagine. Like, we are going to do exactly what he says. We're going to make the mistake exactly as he says in this whole piece, is that we are going to look backward and we are going to think that this is what it's going to look like, and we are going to completely misunderstand just how much innovation is capable, that we are capable of, and how many new things we can actually build when you don't have to have a $100 million bond and a banking license that takes you 5 years to create some stupid one-off payments improvement or a chip in a card as opposed to swiping it. Oh, the revolution. But instead, you have an open, permissionless code. You have an open platform to build whatever the hell you want, and that you can create unique, non-custodial services where you never even have control of your customer's money, and that you can provide this service to anyone in the world, regardless of what border they are standing on the other side of. It is literally going to be the internet all over again. That is why this thing is so important. And I love how he ends this. There's a really great line. It says, you know, just learn about Bitcoin. But learn why its importance is so much greater than the wealth it might create for you and your family. Yes, Bitcoin has number go up technology. Yes, Bitcoin is going to tend to increase in value as time goes on. But the importance, the significance of Bitcoin is way more than the fact that you might 10x or 100x your savings. That is not as important. That's a big deal. Absolutely, that is a big deal. And that could mean the world to somebody who has very little savings, or to somebody who has been drowning in debt for two decades and doesn't see any other way out of it. But it is insignificant in the context of the global societal change that it can induce to have a natural, unmanipulable, sound monetary standard. It is way more important than the simple fact that you can probably make money by investing in it. That is one of the least interesting things about it. The fact that you can make money investing in it is merely a consequence of its world-changing implications. So if you haven't listened to the rest of Bitcoin Audible, get on that now, because that's what we cover in this show, and there's only like 600 episodes or something to cover. So it shouldn't take you too long. Just listen to it on 3x speed, like my brother, because he's absolutely crazy. But you'll get through it really quick. All right. Thank you, guys. We will close this one out. Great piece by Jeff Booth. I am exhausted. It's almost 2 o'clock in the morning. I've been recording all day long. It's been a good one, though. We really dug into some Bitcoin today. Bitcoin Times Volume 3 has been fire, and there's still some awesome pieces left to cover. So do not forget to subscribe to Bitcoin Audible. This is where you're going to hear about it all, and you'll get the best part of the show, Guy's Take. That's me, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And a huge thank you to our sponsors, the HexUp mobile wallet. I love this thing. The BitBox hardware wallet, just so simple and so straightforward. And lastly, the not in my state and I can't stand it, level.co, which is your full-on Bitcoin mobile banking services. And no fee exchange. Gotta check those guys out. Go to guyswan.com for all three. They're right there at the top of the page. And I'll close it out with Jeff Booth's comment that this is bound to be an epic battle. And he says that his hope for humanity is that we are on the winning side. And not only do I think we are on the winning side, but even if we were on the losing side, I think this is the only right side to be on. Because even if the fiat system had a better chance of winning this fight, that is not a thing I want to support. Even if Bitcoin only has a 5% chance of winning, I will happily take that to know that I didn't support the other option. So I'm not going anywhere. Keep fighting the good fight, and I will be here next time to read to you all about it. Until then, guys, take it easy. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.